The Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast is proud to be sponsored by Dr. Spork's 3D Terrain. From retro greenskin outposts to elven fortresses and obelisks, this is hands down the best nostalgic scenery you'll find out there, and all at stupidly reasonable prices. Check it out for yourself by heading over to bedroombattlefields.com/spork, that's S-P-O-R-K, and turn your tabletop into a scene from White Dwarf circa 1994. Andy Chambers not included. Brought to you by bedroombattlefields.com, this is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. My first encounter with Oldhammer came via the incredible Realm of Chaos 80s blog. Since 2012, the site's owner, Orlig, has documented his hobby, shared pictures of beautiful old lead models, and interviewed legendary creators. Brian Ansell, Mike McVeigh, Tony Ackland, Rick Priestley, and Bill King are just a few of the hobby heavyweights that you'll find conversations with over there. It really is a treasure trove for anyone interested in Games Workshop during that uniquely special Ansell era. On this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by Orlig himself, who's in the guest chair for once. We had a great chat about the early days of Oldhammer, the origins of Bring Out Your Lead, and how rumours of his death have been greatly exaggerated. Kicking us off though with the most important question of all, where did the name Orlig come from?
I actually got it because obviously my given name is so common. That years ago at university, when I was creating my first ever email address, I thought I can't have like my name 455,000. So I was reading the Landnámabók, I think that's how you pronounce it, which is an Icelandic, the book of Icelandic settlement history. And there was a page, and there was someone called Orlig, and then someone called Jafnakol, and I put the two together to make my email address, and then dropped the Jafnakol bit, and just stuck with Orlig. And no one else has ever used it. So it's kind of a sort of a unique thing, which I've just stuck with. And whenever I've played computer games or anything else, you know, where you need a name, I've kind of used it. But no one ever knew me as my real name. They just knew me as that. And that was what was really strange about when we finally all met up and did things with the Ansell family. And you were just known as your nickname. So there's people out there I've known for years, and I only know them as some daft moniker. Don't actually really know what their name is. But when you find out what their name is, their name's Barry or something, it kind of loses the power of Lord Archibald or Axiom or something like that. It was just more interesting, wasn't it? I think I was like that part of internet culture.
Yeah, and I mean, speaking of your blog, like I just managed to find my way back to the very start there. So the first post, it looks like February 2012, and you're kind of laying out your plans. So you've got a screenshot of White Dwarf 108 there, and you're just talking.
Yeah, my very first issue. Yeah, I always go on about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
So yeah, you give a wee bit of background there about getting into the hobby and kind of leaving it around 91, 92, you say that the Amiga beckoned. So were you an Amiga fan?
Yeah, oh yeah, big. I mean, I was a Commodore 64 boy. Yeah, I was well into that. And then I think I got a PC about 94. Used to play all those, you know, Lucasfilm and Sierra games, played all that stuff. And it was only when I went back to uni, 97, 98, and, you know, you didn't have anything to do. And I walked back into a Games Workshop store and was horrified with what I saw. I was horrified by what they'd done to all these wonderful metal models that I got rid of, and they had these hideous plastic kits. I remember buying some of the models out there. I remember having, was it Morgana Le Fay? I remember buying that one as a kit and painted that up for a girlfriend. I remember spending ages painting that, and from time to time I would buy the odd kit, but it was always lacking something from me. I'm looking back now. I know what it was lacking. It was lacking the anarchy, that anarchic chaos. Not, you know, not the background chaos, but just that anarchic feel that the Ansell years had, which disappeared when things went corporate. I mean, when you're 10, 11, 12, and you're looking at a White Dwarf magazine, 108, 109, there's bikers in there. You know, you look at Sid, the the artist. He's a biker, and he used to go into Games Workshop stores in the late 80s, and there were like heavy metal dudes in there and bikers, and it all seemed grown up. It all seemed quite dangerous. And then when I went back in again, it was a load of nerds. And I thought, what happened to them scary dudes, you know, that were into Dungeons and Dragons, into sort of fantasy, into sci-fi stuff. It was kind of replaced with a nerd. Then I realized, hang on, I'm not a biker. I'm one of the nerds. I might as well embrace it. You know, but that was a big difference for me, is it kind of lost that uniqueness that the 80s and early 90s had, that cultural shift over to, marketing it at much. I mean, I was, what, how old was I? 10 when I got my first White Dwarf. But it wasn't marketed at a 10-year-old, was it? Because White Dwarf had for a long time been marketed at role players who were much older. They were old teenagers, weren't they? It was a very different readership. But, and I think White Dwarf in the late 80s and early 90s sort of held on to that readership, and lots of kids bought it, but I liked that fact that it was marketed at an older person. When I went back, it was very much kids, wasn't it? When those big box games became, what was it, Warhammer 4th edition and what was it, 2nd edition, Warhammer 40,000. It was a completely different vibe, which I wasn't comfortable with. Though years later, I loved the Silver Age, which, why it was so sad to hear of Paul Sawyer dying, wasn't it, not so long ago? Because I loved the Silver Age. Was it around 2000, 2001? Got my first job. Suddenly I had loads of money. What am I going to do with it? I walked back into Games Workshop again, and I loved that period as well, because the White Dwarf magazine was incredible, wasn't it, when Paul Sawyer was the editor. I mean, there was so much background stuff. It was so much depth. And I stuck with it into the infamous Giant issue, if you remember. Were you an avid reader of White Dwarf in those days?
No, well, not at that period. No, I mean, I think I got my last one in like 98. So,
What was the Giant issue? 2006, 2007, maybe? The Giant issue, it was just the worst thing I'd ever seen. They'd released that plastic giant thing around that time, and the whole magazine was just an advert for that. There was no writing, there was no content. And I remember just giving up. That's what really turned me off of it all after that, because I'd seen it degenerate. Like I said, I saw that wonderful 80s zeitgeist was captured, wasn't it, by the Brian Ansell years. The madness, the creativity, the genius, all that stuff. Because, I mean, even if you look at Games Workshop now, nearly everything that they have was created then in that short period of time, those 5, 6, 7 years. Everything they pretty much have, one way or another, was created then. And ever since that point, they've just been, well, cannibalizing it, improving it, developing it, whatever you want to call it. But those glory days to have been there were really quite profound when you were young. And I think when in the Paul Sawyer era, they were very close to capturing that. I mean, there's some of that metal work. I mean, I've been restoring my old Sisters and Battle stuff recently, and the metal work's beautiful. I mean, really great, beautiful models. I always see a metal model as being a piece of artwork. Someone with skill has created a little character, and that is a piece of art. You can't get the same bit of feeling from a plastic sprue. I know some people out there can work wonders with plastic sprues. I'm not one of those people, and 99% of everybody else are. And you just get identikit figures, don't you, that all look the same. They all have the same vibe, and it's, let's buy the scenery now. Let's have, everything became branded, isn't it? Let's use my hobby knife with Games Workshop on. Let's use my hobby glue. Don't forget my hobby pliers. It all became a bit overwhelming for me. So after the Giant issue, I bugged off. And I can't remember what I did. I think I bought an Xbox.
Yeah, so that would have been like you left the hobby in 91, 92, then you come back in 2004, then you leave a couple of years later again. So when is your third act then?
The third act started, when did it start? I think because you were of that age where I was at work. I became a teacher, started working with other people. Now, in the primary school sector, most of the people you work with are ladies. So, you know, it's unusual for there to be many men in a primary school. But years and years back, I actually had a friend who I worked with. He's called Dan. And he liked Warhammer. He liked Games Workshop stuff. We talked about it on and off. And I remember saying to him, oh, you should have been there, because he was a bit younger than me. You should have been there during the Realm of Chaos era. It was fantastic. It was amazing. And obviously he asked questions about it. You know, nothing really came out of it. But it got me interested in collecting all the stuff. And of course, I was a young teacher, and eBay was all the rage then, wasn't it? Not like now, where it's millions of buy it nows that never shift. I mean, I haven't been on eBay for years, but I remember what it was like near the end of my sort of last collecting period. You had enormous amounts of miniatures in very poor condition, sitting there being unsold for ridiculous prices, and people honestly thinking that the miniatures were worth that. I mean, that's one of the reasons I created the Facebook group, the original Oldhammer Facebook group and the original Oldhammer sort of marketplace groups that we created, to try and get people away from eBay. But when I was started going on eBay, what, around 2007, I think I started going on there, I used to do this thing called 99p-ing, where I'd go on, because obviously I was a teacher, I was unmarried, I didn't have children, plenty of money. I'd go on and I'd put 99p bids on, I don't know, 200 figures, because there'd be so many on there. You know, there was no buy it now, it was an auction site, I think, at that time. And I would just see what I won. And, you know, every now and again, I'd come along and have a look, pay for stuff. And I used to quite like coming home and having, you know, the miniatures that originally, the ones that I had originally owned and lost, I was buying them back again. And then my interest peaked. And then I started to discover, I mean, there was this collecting Citadel miniatures group back then. I think it was on Yahoo. I can't remember what it was. And I didn't realize that one of the main members of that was Steve Casey, who many years later I'd become friends with through sort of the Oldhammer thing. But yeah, I used to look at that as a reference point. And I just collected a vast number of models. And when times were a bit hard, I used to buy them in terrible states, covered in paint, strip them with the good old Dettol, and then resell them. And I'd make myself quite a bit of money sometimes doing that back then, because people didn't know what they had. They weren't really worth anything. There were people like me out there wanting to buy them, but you could buy a job lot for a couple of quid, clean up, put the popular models out, like a Realm of Chaos Champion or something, and sell it for a little bit more. So I used to do that when times were a bit difficult. But I never stopped the eBay collecting. I quite liked coming home and there being something waiting for you, like a goblin archer. Bit sad, really, when you're trying to get a girlfriend, going home, wait there, love, while I open up my goblin horde here and keep it a secret. Not the best thing to do, but I used to do that. And then I got interested in the actual books. I mean, I didn't have many of the books when I was younger. I still have, and I've actually got it in my hand now, my original copy of Warhammer 3rd Edition. I had that book because I never got rid of that. I kept that. I always loved it. And I always kept it with me. I took it to uni with me, and I used to look at it, and it would be like, if only the world was still like that. But I then became interested in all the other publications I didn't have. So I tracked those down. I tracked most of the Warhammer Fantasy roleplay stuff, which I loved, and I played a lot of that actually. In the sort of mid to late 90s, I played that a few times. Did the sort of Enemy Within campaign for people a few times, did that. I collected all those. I obviously got Lost in the Damned, which is something I didn't have. I got Siege. You know, all those books, which I didn't really know existed, because it's difficult now to explain to sort of a modern hobbyist, I suppose, what it was like back then, because you didn't have the internet, you didn't have podcasts, you didn't have access to anything beyond what you could find in a shop. So a lot of supplements, things like Macdeath or the Book of the Astronomicon, that kind of thing, I didn't even know they existed. So I was discovering as I was going along all this background stuff to the era I loved, and I was recollecting it and getting to enjoy it for the first time. And I started to build up a White Dwarf archive from, I think, what issue did I pick? I can't remember if it was issue 90. I think I decided I'm going to start with issue 90 and go all the way along to about 152, I think, which is when Warhammer Fantasy Battle 4th edition comes out. So it took me a couple of years to collect all those. Because, I mean, those mags used to sell for, what, 50p, £1 back then? So I was amassing all those magazines. I was amassing all those books, amassing all those miniatures. Randomly, there was no plan. I just loved this stuff. And you'd find real oddities. Like I found, I think it's quite funny, I found someone sold a copy of the Arcane Immorials. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about there. It was the original Ali Morrison painted like transfers from about 86, I think they were. Real glorious 1980s things. Go and check them out if you've never seen the Arcane Immorials. They were bright colours, you know, they were a bit like those 80s tattoos you used to put on yourself. And I found one of those on eBay, and only one had been cut out. And I remember buying it and scanning it and putting it on maybe Warseer, or I might have even put it on my blog, I can't remember. And it's funny because I was looking for it the other day and I actually found it on some other website. And I thought, oh, someone else has put it on. And as I was looking at it, I realized it was my original scan. You know, all those years ago, it's still out there, doing the rounds, people looking at it. But Arcane Immorials was a fantastic discovery that I had no idea of. And I was gradually piecing all this stuff together myself, because there wasn't anything online. There was nothing online about Warhammer 30 Edition. If you went onto the internet, I mean, I started my blog, what was it, 2012, didn't I, started my blog. You went onto the internet then and you looked for Warhammer 3rd Edition, you'd find nothing. I mean, if you Googled Citadel back then, you'd get modern stuff occasionally. There wasn't a huge amount out there. I think I discovered So Legends, isn't it? Wasn't it Stuff of Legends, which was a sort of a miniature catalogue that was out there. And you had people like Orc Lord and their collections were out there on So Demons. So you could see there were some people out there, but there wasn't very much at all. And I certainly couldn't find the answers, because I knew I had gaps in my collection. I knew there were things that I didn't know. There were pieces that I needed to fill in the puzzle. So I was looking out there. And as I was looking out there, I discovered this thing called a blog. Now, I'd never seen a blog in my life, but I discovered it. And it was by a guy who back then was known as Fansants. Bizarre name, like I said, everyone had a funny name back then. His real name, Steve. Guy I've known for years. Actually, I saw him last summer when I went back to the foundry. And he wrote a blog called The Tea's Getting Cold. Presumably, I never asked him, presumably a reference to the final episode of original Doctor Who, isn't it? Because I think that's something Sylvester McCoy says, isn't it? Somewhere it's the tea's getting cold. So I found this blog, and if you go and look on the Tea's Getting Cold, he did, I can't remember, one of the scenarios, I can't remember, it wasn't Lichmaster, it wasn't Macdeath, so it must have been Orc's Drift. He had done Orc's Drift, and he collected the original models. Well, now, I didn't know about the scenarios, because I wasn't a second edition kind of guy, I was a third edition guy, but I became very interested in what he was doing on this blog, because he had the original figures, which is something I always wanted to see. I didn't want to see that plastic horror that I used to see when you go into these sort of games workshop shops that I was going into, and the things I was seeing. He had the stuff that I wanted to see, and he had buildings made, proper buildings made out of foam board and all this stuff. He'd set them all up, the pictures, just like Wayne the Duke, you know, had done. I mean, I recently interviewed him and talked to him about that famous board. But here he was. He was a Steve Fansass guy. He was producing and doing stuff exactly what I wanted to do. And I thought, wow, this guy's amazing. So after reading his blog for a bit and looking at all the pictures, well, mostly looking at the pictures because I'm one of those people that looks at people, I saw there was another guy there called Garth. And he was doing another blog called Warhammer for Adults. And like me, he was a strict Warhammer 3rd edition man, you know, and he was collecting all kinds of bits and pieces like that. And that was like my starting point. I wanted to be like them. I wanted to produce a blog and sort of, because these were people who were like the same stuff as me. Because if you walked into a hobby shop, you know, what era is this? Circa 2010. What you're painting, and you said, oh, some Kev Adam goblins from 1986, people would have looked at you strangely. They would have said, who's Kev Adams? People wouldn't have known who he was. And suddenly you could talk to people who knew what you were talking about. They had similar collections to you, and it was all very exciting. So I decided, I'm going to have a go at this. I'm going to start a blog myself, primarily to stop myself having to do any work. Because I think it was a weekend. I can't remember when it was, really. I think I was supposed to be doing something for school, which I didn't want to do. So I decided to try and write a blog post. And I probably wrote, I can't remember what I wrote now, some waffly nonsense about White Dwarf 108. I think I'll probably talk about the other blogs I saw. that kind of stuff. And I just wrote it. And then I set out what I wanted to do, which was to try and create some armies of original figures, maybe a game board, and maybe play a game. You know, and after that, some people commented. People started talking to me about it. So I wrote more posts as time went by. I got to know online Vincent, Steve and Garth and a few other people. And we had this sort of quiet little corner of the internet going where we'd write things or paint things or put things on and we'd talk about them online. And then gradually more and more people got involved. By more and more people, I think I meant two or three people back then. And Garth, who ran Warhammer for Adults, he had this great idea. He said we should have like a vintage rally of vintage Citadel figures. And I remember he said to me, I think we could get at least 12 people to go. So he was really excited. We were really excited about the idea of there being 12 people in the world who would be interested in playing Warhammer 3rd edition. And over a period of time, we were talking to each other about this vintage rally idea. I mean, we tried all kinds of things. I mean, as more and more people got involved, I think Garth did posts about playing. I think there were early versions of web browser software where you could create your own miniatures and move them around. People had a go at doing that. I think people had a go at using webcams to do battles and stuff. I had that friend I said called Dan, and we did a Realm of Chaos sort of campaign, which had started just before the blog and kind of went on in the background. I was doing that, but it was very low key. And the big thing that was holding us back was the fact that enthusiasts, as I've always called people, are you an enthusiast? That comes from my father, who was a railway modeler, and he always used to get a magazine, I don't know what it's called, Railway Modeling or something, and it said underneath, for the enthusiast. So I hated railway modeling, but I did love fantasy modeling, so I kind of nicked that word. So the enthusiasts, what was holding us back was the huge distance, because we were spread all over over England, Scotland, Ireland. I think we had someone from Australia, a couple of Americans. But the actual idea of getting together and doing anything just seemed like an impossibility in 2012 when we initially started. Little did we know what would happen in the months to come. That's how it started. And it was a lovely time. I mean, in my sort of hobby experience life, that was one of the best periods, because more and more people were being inspired. There was a real grassroots feel. Each week there were new bloggers doing the same thing, and there was real momentum. We didn't have a name to call it. And then there was that old hammer contract, wasn't there, that a character called Zoo wrote about old gaming. And that kind of where the name Old Hammer came from. And then suddenly everyone had a name. We could all jump on it. Some people tried to claim ownership over this name and it all got a bit silly. And there were people that I was starting to talk to from the studio, design studio, who had used this term informally. Oh, let's play an Old Hammer game from an old set of rules. And of course, ourselves being a bunch of bloggers, there were plenty of people out there who we had no connection with who were playing older editions of games. We thought it was unusual, but actually out there in other communities, it wasn't that unusual. But as soon as we had that Old Hammer name, the blogs all started to join together. And I can't remember, some guy did the artwork. I remember Zoo did the original Old Hammer one that was used for a long time. And then some other guys did some other Old Hammer artwork. At one point, even the mighty Wayne England, that great Games Workshop artist, the late great Wayne England, made one for us as well. And we were using these as banners just to say we're part of this Old Hammer thing. But it didn't really go anywhere because we couldn't meet. But yeah, it was a great thing to, you know, work all day, come home, log on, see what someone else had done. It was really inspiring to finally see the stuff that we loved.
It sounds like you're kind of leading us here to the origins of Bring Out Your Lead then.
Well, yeah, well, what? Well, I think before that, we tried some other things. A great guy who was known online as Ernie, and he had a brother, Snicket. We tried to play The Enemy Within as a blog. So we tried to play it as a blog. It didn't last very long because it was an awful lot of work. You know, and you need a real commitment. I mean, I did Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay several times for Enemy Within. And you do need real serious commitment for that kind of gaming, don't you? And I always hold my hat off. And I know Dungeons & Dragons is big now because of Stranger Things. But you really need a commitment. You have to, all of you have to be in the room at the same time and really get into that Dungeons & Dragons. And we couldn't do it. A lot of us were recently married, had kids, you know, jobs, and it all went a bit, it just ran out of steam. But around this time, I got an email from Marcus Ansell. And it was funny because that email was in my spam box. Because I was getting quite a lot of emails in those days from, you know, other enthusiasts, like I still do now. People will just out of the blue email me something. You always have to check your spam box. And there I was checking my spam box, and there was Marcus Ansell's email. And I thought, oh, Marcus Ansell, I recognise that name. Obviously, Brian Ansell. And I clicked on it, and they had picked up, well, we didn't realise that the Ansell family had been enjoying our blogs, had been, you know, quite entertained, I think, and amused and appreciative of the things we were doing because it was their era. And they just, you're talking about having a vintage rally, you know, come to our sort of property, our place of work, which was in Nottingham, the old abattoir site, and do it there. So that really built up momentum. So talking to the other guys, I mean, it wasn't my thing. I mean, organising something like that is not something that I would have the skills for. You know, I could do a sports day and a parents' evening, but organising something like that is not something I have the skills for. Thankfully, we had Garth. Now, Garth was a great organiser and still is. I mean, he's always organised the Bring Out Your Lead things. So I think we had this phone call. We had this sort of, those big big old hammer types. I remember we had this phone call and we planned out what we were going to do and how we were going to approach it, and we had this phone call, and yeah, and we all picked a date and we were invited down to the old abattoir site in Nottingham to sort of get together. And I think my thing I did then is I'd done a lot of Realm of Chaos stuff, so I was suggesting that we did a Realm of Chaos warband game where you could just bring a little warband along and just field it, and it would just be a, you know, free for all riot of a game, very much like games were in the 80s and early 90s. Because one of the things I didn't like was it almost turned into a game of chess, you know, playing Warhammer. When I went into Warhammer stores and tried it, it wasn't about the figures, it wasn't about the scenery, it wasn't about the background, it was about this codex that people had in front of them. And you had to outwit your opponent by coming up with some loophole or strange interpretation of a book. It wasn't about the spectacle, it wasn't about the art, it wasn't about telling a story, all the things that I remembered. It wasn't about that, it was this bizarre concept. I remember watching one game in a Games Workshop, and a guy was losing. And so he bought a box of miniatures, you know, off the shelf, and then put them on the table. He didn't even bother to open them up. That was going to be his unit. And he actually used the box and moved it around. It was just people moving toys around. There was no story. There was no, it didn't seem fun to me. So this first meet at the old abattoir site was all about that. And that's why I did that Realm of Chaos thing. And yeah, I met Warlord Paul there, who became another big old hammer guy. He was like the ultimate GM. You know, he knew Dungeons and Dragons, he knew Warhammer 3rd Edition. He would GM things. It was just something he naturally came into doing. And we had this fantastic game going on. But what was absolutely stunning when we went to that, when I went there, I remember arriving and the first person I saw was Tony Yates, you know, the famous Tony Yates, who's still with us, a great guy who did loads of stuff for Foundry and behind the scenes, and of course, Laserburn and stuff like that, and was a great friend of Brian and all the people that were behind the early versions of Warhammer. Met him, he was eating a sausage roll, and he said, come in, come in, come in. It was funny because nobody knew who anyone was. We didn't know what we looked like. So he had to keep pointing out who everybody was. But yeah, we had a great time. And I think the very famous Harry, who had been very big in Warhammer and 40K on places like Warseer. Warseer was a place I used to use a lot years ago, and Harry was famous on there. Harry was there, and I think they did the Shrine of Rig. I remember they had massive scenery, just like I remembered as being younger. They had all this great scenery that they would bring along, stuff that I hadn't means to do. So that was fantastic to see. And Harry also brought a Warhammer Giant, which actually takes me back to my hated Giant issue, because in the Giant issue they talked about, Games Workshop talked about this famous Alan and Michael Perry Giant, and they didn't even have a picture of it. They couldn't. They said in the magazine, we haven't got a picture of it. It's that old, a bit like the Chicken Dragon. And here was Harry, and he actually had a fully painted one. So I'd never actually seen one at this point. I mean, they're quite well known now, because you see them for sale and you see them around. But at that time, to see a Citadel Giant and pick it up was really quite something. And I think we had about 20, 25 people there. I don't know, maybe go back and have a look if you're interested at that blog page I did about it. I think I took a picture. I remember taking a picture at the first one of the busiest moment of it, to try and make it look like there were lots of people there. I think there was about, I don't know, a few people in the shot. I think there were about 20 guys there, but it was marvelous. It was marvelous to see all these like-minded people. And I met Diane Ansell. And if you've ever met Diane Ansell, you'll see why Games Workshop was so successful in the 1980s, because she was such an incredibly driven woman. And I think she really drove Brian and really drove Games Workshop to where it was going. And she certainly drove to bring out a lead shows that I went to, particularly that first one. And she was a really nice person. She was really, you know, open and honest. Come on in, come on in, come on in. And yet we were so immersed in what we were doing. And she was sort of, they'd put food on and stuff. And then we started to notice that there was a cabinet up the back of the foundry. And in the cabinet were the original figures from Saves of Darkness, the actual figures that we'd spent 20 years looking at. And we were like, what, they still exist? So we didn't realize at this point that they all still existed. And it was like, yeah, let's get them out. So the cabinet was open, and there I was holding some of these figures. It was like we forgot to take pictures of this stuff. We were so amazed by it. I think in the end I took a picture of a famous piece of scenery that appeared in the Warhammer Fantasy Battle rulebook, a round polystyrene tower. Took a picture of that with my Slambo model on. I remember doing that. But yeah, I mean, the stuff she brought out, and I think, if I remember correctly, Harry the Hammer, the famous piece of artwork which recently was put on sale, was there. It was just there. This incredible piece of art was just there. And I remember holding it and looking at it, and it was just so overwhelming that we were seeing this stuff that we'd been interested in for, you know, 20, 30 years. And then after we, you know, were getting on with the games, I remember Diane said, oh, let me introduce you and Garth to Brian. And Brian turned up in a T-shirt. He turned up. Rick Priestley turned up. Tony Huff, or Tony Howe, never did work out how to say his name. He turned up. John Stallard was there. Suddenly, we later called them Warhammer celebs. Are the Warhammer celebs coming? They were there. And that the beautiful thing about those people is they weren't any different from us. These guys were just people who loved miniatures. They loved games. They loved making scenery. They just happened to do it as a job. And it was just bizarre that, you know, people were signing rule books. I got my Slaves to Darkness signed. Everyone was signing it. It was just an incredible moment to realize, one, we could meet. And the idea is we could do this again in the future, and that the stuff we loved still existed. I mean, there was only a handful of those models there, and I think it was Harry the Hammer was there, I think, that time, and a few other bits and pieces were there, like that White Dwarf clock that we never found out what that was about. all that stuff was in. It was just incredible. So we had such a wonderful time. We had to do it again. But the abattoir was in a rough old place. And I mean, that's when you realised, I mean, if you're ever lucky enough to meet Brian or his son Marcus, they were very, very, very funny. They were very funny, witty people, and they would tell great stories. Anyone who's done anything, anyone who's accomplished anything in their life, you know, has great stories. And they had great stories. They told a story about this abattoir site, which they were going to get rid of, that I don't know if it was in that site or if it was another one of their sites, that they actually had the lead off the roof stolen. And they'd come in to work one day to find all the lead off the roof of the factory had been stolen, which was unfortunate. But luckily, the thieves had never noticed that there were absolutely tons of lead in the actual workshop themselves. Mm-hmm. they hadn't seen it. They hadn't stolen it. So these were the kinds of stories that we were finding out about. And that, obviously, my great interest was meeting and talking to and getting people's views about the time. That's why I was doing all those interviews. So learning this stuff, it just fascinated me, and I wanted to find out as much as I possibly could. And you have to remember, social media was different then, wasn't it? It was a different era. Facebook was a friendly place. It's hard to imagine that now, isn't it? Facebook was friendly. And that if you approach someone on Facebook, like, I don't know, Andy Chambers or Phil Lewis, or who else did I interview? Loads of people. Andy Craig. If you approached them and said, "Oh, will you do an interview for my blog?" People were like, "Yeah, of course." Now, if someone sends you a message and you don't know who they are on Facebook now, it's like delete, you know. But at that time, it was really quite open, and it was very easy to meet people. And when we created the Facebook group, I was the original admin there, and I would be letting. I'd be letting these Warhammer legends into the group when they wanted to join it. So it was really easy for me to let them in, introduce myself and say, "Can you be interviewed?" Because I was so interested in the history. I mean, now we have people like Jordan Sorcery who do a marvelous job at making these video things. And of course, at that time, none of that stuff existed. So, you know, everyone seemed to do their own thing. Garth was amazing at organizing the Warhammer things. The Ansell family jumped on producing all their miniatures and the sort of background stuff that we needed to run these shows. Other people, you know, produced fantastic games. And that kind of left me. It took me forever to paint anything. I thought, well, I'm actually just going to write some stuff, you know, because I can write things. So the interviews and the articles I wrote just came from. That was just the thing I did. And I think there were so many of us doing different things, all leading it in the same direction, that the first Bring Out Your Lead or Old Hammer Weekend, I think it was very late August we did it, if I remember correctly. Yeah, I remember it was just brilliant. But the abattoir site wasn't the best site to use. It was quite cold. I don't think the Ansells could put on the show that they wanted to put on, because he was a great showman, I think, at heart, and having... You know, all the games day, that kind of stuff, that was all, you know, was still very much, you know, their sort of thing that they did. And then we were invited, weren't we, to go back to Stoke Hall. That so successful was Brian as a businessman, you know, beyond Games Workshop, that he'd bought himself a stately home. So we were promptly invited, I think a year later, I think it was, to go to Stoke Hall, and we went for many years, and that was incredible. The place was incredible. I don't know if you did you ever go there? Have you ever been to the Foundry site?
Yeah, I've been to the last couple of Bring Out Your Lead.
Yeah. So you know, as you walk down into that sort of, it's the stable block, isn't it? There was a stable block. I think it was involved. I think Brian told me it was involved in the Battle of Stoke Field, and there were various things going on there, and there was a church nearby. And yeah, we were stunned when we saw this place. And obviously a whole year had gone by and they had put a small collection of their collection out, the artworks and the miniatures. And this was just, you know, it was stunning to see all this sort of stuff. And the fact that, you know, Marcus, Brian's son, we just opened the cabinet out to the likes of us and get stuff out. And we got to, you know, look at and handle things that we'd been interested in for years. That was what was always strange. Steve Casey, who had done the Eldritch Epistles, he had actually taken photographs a lot of this stuff on his blog. So we knew what a lot of the stuff looked like, because there were some really famous figures out there, like Mike McVeigh's work. We didn't know what the background, the back looked like, because they'd never taken a photo. And actually, if you turn some of them around, not all of them, but actually the art wasn't so good on the back. Because remember, these were professional painters. They painted the front really nicely. And then when you turn it around, they didn't do the same on the back, because it was never going to be photographed. Really interesting little things like that you would find. Things just got bigger and better. And as the years went by, more people got interested, more people came. It was just a wonderful, incredible time. I met so many great friends, like Stuart, who I still see occasionally now. All the guys that I talked about before, loads more. But then we got to meet people like John Blanche came, the wonderful and unique Kev Adams, who came, who years later did little miniatures of me and my children for me, because he used to do his sculptor head. I mean, he was a great character that we would meet, and it was just an incredible experience. Of all the things I did in my life, a sort of entertainment wise, it was an absolutely incredible journey to have started out writing a blog and hoping, like Garth had said to me, there might be 12 people interested, to create something that happens, well, to have a small part in creating something that happens every year and became so famous and saw people coming from all around the world and inspiring loads of other people to play their version of Warhammer, especially as more and more people get disillusioned. I mean, I think that's quite normal, isn't it? There's a period of everything, music, food, travel, movies that you like. So just go do that. You know, you don't have to keep up with the Joneses, don't you? I know that's important to some people, but that was the particular era that I liked and other people liked, and we got on with it.
The Mini Gamer is a free weekly email newsletter where I curate 5 cool things that caught my eye in the hobby this past week. Subscribe today and have the next edition sent straight to your inbox by going to bedroombattlefields.com/email. That's bedroombattlefields.com/email. And now back to the show. You talked about your written interviews, and you've obviously had the pleasure of spending a fair bit of time with Brian Ansell. As far as I know, and I could be wrong, but you're the only hobbyist I know that's interviewed Brian not once but twice on your blog.
Oh, well, it was the same interview. Brian was a really interesting. Anyone who met him would have known. That's what's really sad about the modern world of Games Workshop, I think, is they owe all these corporates now, you know, all these computer games and everything that are out there, they owe him so much, and they just ignore him. They ignore him and Rick Priestley. They ignore, but you know, they, you know, in Brian's view, I remember I said to this once, yeah, but I sold it. I did what I want and I sold it. But they, you know, they owe so much to the creativity of these people. It wasn't just Brian, and I know what Brian and Co had done. He created a design studio of the very best hobbyists and just left them to get on with the business of creating cool stuff to sell. And it doesn't matter how zany it was, you know, people would create it. I mean, some of the things that Games Workshop produced in the 80s, imagine them producing them now. I mean, we used to have goblins that used to stick 2 fingers up, didn't we? We had we had characters that would, you'll be urinating, didn't we? We had the torture chamber. We had, you know, real 80s stereotype stuff going on that a corporate company now would be horrified for. And I mean, you see the furore now of the female space marine. I mean, I've seen that online, where the hate on Facebook about there aren't female Astartes. That doesn't happen. Games Workshop's gone woke. Female Astartes. And of course, I knew when the first Rogue Trader figures came out, they did have female Space Marines, because I used to have one in my collection. I had them. I remember seeing them there, and I can't remember who told me. It might have been Rick Priestley. I think I asked him once, you know, what happened with the female Marines, and they simply didn't sell. So they made the 2 tester female Marines, didn't they? And they tried to sell them with the Rogue Trader stuff. No one bought them. So if they didn't sell, they made something else. So, you know, back in 87, if people had gone crazy for female space marines, people wouldn't be losing their tempers over the internet now about the need to have a female head on a plastic sprue, because it would have been part of the law. And it's like the other things that we learn talking to these people is like the Horus Heresy, which is probably the biggest 40K thing, isn't it, out there. The reason that existed was because they only had the money when they made Space Marine to create one sprue. So they had to have two armies exactly the same. So I think Jervis Johnson, wasn't it? And Rick Priestley was behind the creation of the Horus Heresy, purely because they could only afford one sprue of the same model. So they were going to do it in two different coloured plastics. And that's a huge thing now, isn't it? It's like bigger than 40K, I think, now, with the books and audios and everything. And future TV show, isn't it, with a guy who was Superman. I can't remember his name now. You know, it was finding out little things like that for me, I mean, I did an archaeology degree. History was my thing in the background. So I kind of, when no one else was doing it, I was still naturally interested in the history of things. I mean, there were some great moments out there, like when we were talking about mighty empires and the mighty fortress. And this was at one of the Oldhammer weekends. And Brian disappeared and came back, and he had the original metal version of the mighty fortress that they made in polystyrene. And I remember him just bringing it out. And for a long time, it used to be around the till at Foundry, the actual metal thing. And it weighed a ton. And it had been hand sculpted. Who did it? I can't remember now. But yeah, that was astonishing to see the original mighty fortress. And he brought out some of the old, like the Warhammer Cottage, you know, that real famous article in the modeling workshop. He had hundreds of these buildings that were made in the studio. And I mean, I asked him, why have you still got them? And he said, the company was mine, so when I sold it, I took all the miniatures. And of course, that made me then realize that's why it went a bit rubbish in my eyes, because Brian took all the good stuff with him and they didn't have anything. So that's why they very quickly had to release new editions of 40K and new editions of Warhammer. And why, if you look at White Dwarf at that time, all the great historic figures suddenly disappear because he took them all with him. But thank goodness he did, because we found out that years later, Games Workshop management just chucked most of that historic art out and it was in a skip. And I've actually met a couple of guys whose names will not be mentioned, who actually went into that skip and did rescue artworks, and the original Realm of Chaos scenery was rescued. But the vast majority of that famous artwork, the originals, were junked, apart from stuff that was in the collections of the late Tim Pollard and the Ansells themselves, which were fantastic to see. So I'm glad a lot of this stuff survives. What its ultimate fate will be, who knows? But I was very appreciative to have been able to see this stuff at the time and actually to have handled it and seen it. I remember we were invited to Brian's 60th birthday at Stoke Hall, which was a great occasion, full of Warhammer celebs. And I remember standing beer in hand, spending a long time talking to Wayne England about his artwork and stuff. And Diane had put food on. I remember going to the toilet there. And as I went into the toilet in Stoke Hall, there was just loads of artwork. I remember leaning up against the wall in the toilet, and I went in, and being a clumsy chap, I walked it again, I banged into it, you know, and one of the paintings sort of wobbled, so I went to straighten it, and it was all classic Games Workshop art that was just stacked up, you know, like you and I would stack up some paintings when we were maybe redecorating a room. They'd just done exactly the same, and it was like, oh my god, the front covers of White Dwarf in here, oh my god, this, like, this incredible artwork. So remember, we came out of the toilet. Have you seen what's in the toilet? Well, what's in the toilet? It's like stuff in there. So then everybody wanted to go to the toilet to have a look at these paintings that were stacked up in the corner. I mean, I remember another time when Brian took me into Stoke Hall, and in the big room where Wayne England had painted this mural all around, he had all this stuff out. He just got all these boxes out and he was showing me this stuff. There was more stuff that you could take in. And there was this huge dog that they had at the time. It was just barking the whole time. And he was obviously wanting to kill me, this dog. But Brian's shuffling around in his slippers, showing me unreleased Imperial Guard figures, which to this day I've never seen in anyone's collection. I wish I'd asked more at the time about them. This dog was going, rah, 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 and someone shouting, Brian, stop that dog from shouting. It was such a sort of, you know, domestic scene. Yeah, I was surrounded by this stuff that I was fascinated in. I was fascinated by all this stuff. And of course, Kev Adams had been working there and he was making all these absolutely bonkers greens of goblins and faces, and very rude some of them were. I did have them in my collection. One of the things I'd like to get my collection back in the future. Bits are slowly coming back to me, but yeah, he had some wonderfully rude goblin and orc figures that he had done at that time. Just really creative, fun stuff. And of course, me personally and many collectors will be enormously appreciative of the fact that the Ansell family started actually casting a lot of this stuff back up for us, and that you could buy the ninjas again and you could buy a lot of these figures again, because he still had the masters for them. And some of those early Rogue Trader figures came out as well. And of course the wizards. And every time you go back to the foundry, it was the same this year when I went, or last year when I went, what are they going to cast up this time? And it was just wonderful to see so many of those figures and to do things like pick up those really rare ones, like, you know, the little blue wizard off the combat cards. We had him the other day. And that's what I was really pleased about, because, you know, people often ask me, you know, what's the greatest thing that ever happened to you? What was your great hobby moment? And actually, it was when I did the Midlands Troll. Have you ever heard of the Midlands Troll?
No.
It's quite a rare figure. It was back in the day when they used to do caricatures as Games Workshop staffers. And they made I can't remember, I think it was a D&D figure. And is it an owl? Was it an owl bear or something? Or something, I can't remember now. But anyway, it had a body and it had a head of a chap with a beard. And someone sculpted Brian's head on it. And it became the Midlands Troll, because of course he was from the Midlands. And there was a number of these. I think there was another one of him they made called General Manager Attacking. It just shows you that zany 80s sense of humour I always liked about Games Workshop at that time. Anyway, the Midlands Troll, I managed to get my hands on, found it online. It was a horrendous lump of lead, really in terrible condition. And I had my cleaning system, which was to use the Dettol, which my mum had always used on my wounded arms and legs in the 80s. So it was quite apt. I can't remember how I discovered the wonderful cleaning properties of Dettol. Because my dad had always encouraged me to use brake fluid, but that melted plastic. But somewhere along the lines, I discovered Dettol and the wonderful use of Dettol. I think I should get shares from Dettol, the number of people I have recommended for that, for paint stripping. I mean, it's well known now, but back then, people didn't know so much about Dettol when I was doing it. But that was always a trusty smell. When you opened up that eBay package and it smelled of Dettol, you knew you had a connoisseur on your hands. When someone had cleaned it up with Dettol. So I Dettoled up this Midlands Troll and painted it up, you know, to look like who it is, baseball Brian. I painted it up. And then I gave him a Foundry T-shirt. So I painted it yellow and put some Foundry lettering on it. I remember keeping it, and I think I put it on my blog a few times. And I always wanted to get my pictures, my miniatures in White Dwarf. I'm sure we all did, didn't we? Back in the 80s when you used to get your monthly copy of White Dwarf. You never saw anything else, did you? That was your only reference point. So you waited every month, didn't you, for your magazine? And I would go straight for Heavy Metal and look at all the painted figures and then hopefully try and copy what I saw. And it would always be a total disaster because I didn't know how to paint back then. But I always wanted to be in White Dwarf. And I'd said to Brian many years earlier, I'd said, you know, you've seen my figures. You know, would I have got into White Dwarf in the days? Would you have sent a team to photograph them, or would I have been invited down? He said, oh, yeah. So I was always quite pleased by that. But I still wanted something in that cabinet, didn't I? So I did my Midlands Troll and I painted it out. And I said to him, Brian, have you got every figure you ever released by Games Workshop? And he said, yeah, pretty much. And anyway, I'd whip this Midlands Troll out. I go, have you got this one? And he didn't, and he snatched it out of my hands real quick. I'll have that. And so, yeah, I gave it to him. And that was fantastic, to go back last August and to go to the cabinets of these incredible miniatures that have been painted by Mike McVeigh, or, you know, Dave Andrews, you know, Seared, Colin Dixons, and all the other people that the Foundry employed afterwards to do those wonderful models. And there, right next to that combat card dwarf, I forget his name, was my Midlands Troll with the Foundry T-shirt. And it was fantastic because I hadn't been there for years. I hadn't been there for 4 or 5 years. It was fantastic to go back and see that there was my figure that I painted, and it was still in there. And as far as I know, it's still in there now, sitting next to him. So yeah, my greatest achievement in sort of my hobby world was getting something in that cabinet. And a little bit of my work, is as poor as it is and as meager it is as it is, my skill, it's standing alongside the legends of people like Mike McVeigh and John Blanche, people like that. So that's my tiny little contribution, I think, to things.
Yeah,
is that one figure.
I'm looking at a photo on your site now.
Have you found it, the Midlands Troll?
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, you are a fantastic painter. Like, I mean, your blog's very active at this time now as well. You're posting a lot of stuff. Like,
I barely got re-going recently. Obviously, I'm doing a house up. Got divorced. We lost everything. Got a new partner. We're building a new life. So 99% of my time is doing up the house.
Mm.
So I don't have a huge amount of time to do stuff. But I'd like to do stuff. I've got my plans. I've got my own workshop. Yeah, I found it now. Beware the Midlands Troll.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, there he is. There he is, from 1983. And then the original one, the other one that I had. I can see I can mention someone else here that has to be mentioned when we talk about Oldhammer, and that was Chico. I've mentioned Chico's blurry photos in that. Now, he is a guy that, if you're interested in the history of Oldhammer and blogging, is you've got to check out his Oldhammer on a Budget. He was a great character. Chico was. He was a real character. And that was the thing about Oldhammer, and that was one of the things about early Games Workshop as well, is that they were real characters. When you met people like Warlord Paul or Chico or Garth or all the other people I met over the years, Harry, they were real characters as well. We were all unique people. And I think that era, I don't know, at that time, I don't think maybe it attracted unique people. I've never met a boring, never met a boring person. I bring out your lead place. So I always liked the way that this funny hobby, I think I said it before, didn't I, about the Warhammer celebs at the time, is we were all gamers first.
Mm-hmm.
We were all painters. We were all collectors first. The fact that they happened to be working and producing it was secondary to that fact. So we were all sharing a love and of something and of a time and memories of that time. You know, it wasn't just a job. And that's one of the things I think Rick Priestley said to me, and he paraphrased Brian, and he said, if you mix the creative side with the financial side, you are doomed. You know, I think Rick said, and Brian wasn't wrong, because obviously Rick stayed there and went on to experience what happened later. And you can certainly see the creativity stop, can't you? Mm. And then we go into endless editions. I mean, what edition are we on now? Is it 10th edition Warhammer 40,000?
Yeah, I'm not.
I mean, how many editions do you need? How many editions of something do you need? If that's your business model, is to constantly reproduce a new edition so everyone has to buy everything again. That's your business model. I mean, the original business model that we all loved was get loads of crazy guys who are really talented in a room and let them create interesting things, and then people will buy them. I think that's another great thing about things like Salute now, that's actually happened. You go to Salute, there's people like Jeff Simmons, Finn McCool, Oakbound, I think is his company, a really, really talented guy who produces, is it called The Woods he produces? I mean, he's one of many people that I met. Curtis Fowl was another one. Ramshackle Games, I think he had, and loads of other people who actually turned this into a cottage industry, didn't you? And now you go to somewhere like Salute, and there are some absolutely crazy, funny, weird things out there now. So I think it's very much like PC gaming, isn't it? Is that games became so big and so expensive. Games Workshop, if you want to call that, became so big and so expensive that people went elsewhere. And those smaller, more imaginative people with crazy ideas, new ideas, were able to, you know, make their mark. And that's something that I'm really pleased to see when I get to go to places like Salute, because here we are in this supposedly AI doomed world, aren't we? Where we're all supposed to be, you know, glued to screens, doom scrolling. And there's those of us who enjoy a hobby which, you know, allows you to be creative, allows you to produce whatever you want to produce, paint whatever you want to produce, collect whatever you want to collect, whether or not it was made last week or last century. You know, it's you're not looking at a screen, are you? You're being, and there's so many disciplines, isn't there? There's art, there's 3D construction, there's scenery making, there's research, you know, there's plenty of people out there who want to research stuff, you know, and none of it really requires a screen, apart from when you do your little write-up or you record your podcast. I think that's something else that draws those unique and unusual people in, is the fact that it is a very creative and personal hobby. And that's one thing that what keeps me going back to the blog. Some people tell me blogs aren't viable anymore, and I think, what a load of old nonsense. They're just not viable to someone who wants to have AI produced dross spoon-fed into their minds, doesn't it, every single day, because some of the stuff out there is dire. But if you're reading something someone's hastily typed up at 10 p.m. just before they go to bed about some dark elf they painted, and it's about them and their views and their feelings, that's far more interesting than some AI slop that you see. Because it's really easy, isn't it, to get, let's get a picture of an artwork and get AI to say something about it, and then let's post it online. That's not content, is it? It's repetition. You see that on YouTube all the time. And actually, it was YouTube that got me back into blogging, because I'd lost all my codes, and because I hadn't got the computer, and I'm the sort of person that can't ever remember anything. I couldn't remember how to log back into Blogger or Facebook or anything like that. And to be honest with you, I just thought, sod it. And then I got that part of my life over, you know, because I remember a lot of my children and the stuff that I was doing at the time when I look at that kind of stuff. And that can be painful, can't it, when your life changes. But no, something kept nagging at me. I kept nagging. And remember, then Brian passed away. And I remember that was really upsetting. I saw it on the news, popped up. We all knew he was ill. People can't last forever, but that really made me think, oh God, you know, maybe I should go back. But then, you know, I was doing up a house, we had loads of challenges, and that actually interested me. I was on YouTube one day at school looking for videos, and I don't know why, but I had a quick look, didn't I, to see, you know, what was out there in the world of miniatures, and I discovered Jordan Sorcery. He was doing something. I thought, oh, look, there's a guy doing history of Games Workshop. That's brilliant. And I can't remember if he was reviewing a book that someone else had written, because I know there's quite a few books people have done where they've researched what happened at the design studio. Far better job than I ever did. So they're things I'm interested in reading in the future. But yeah, he did a video, and he did one about Malal, wasn't it? Because I did those famous posts, Malignancy of Malal, when I was talking to Tony Ackland, and he showed me those unreleased artworks that he had kicking about, as he did, of the Malau pantheon that was unused in Realm of Chaos. And that was very interesting, learning about that. But anyway, as he was talking about it, and I was pleased actually to see that Realm of Chaos was 80s was like referenced, because loads of my scans appears all over the place, and stuff from Steve Casey and other people who I knew, it's just being used, you know, people just nicked it. And they use it to kind of just spout the same on us. And that annoyed me. But this Jordan Sorcery guy, you know, he's naming his sources. He's doing a good job. And then as I was going through the comments underneath YouTube, people were talking about whatever happened to Orlig. Whatever happened to him, he just disappeared. I heard he was dead, someone said. I thought, oh my God. And I started looking through this YouTube post. I thought, people think I was dead. Oh my God. Because I remember at the time I had sort of illness, but that was because of the stress of your life unraveling, isn't it, really? So I forgot, people thought I was dead. I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? I was quite shocked. And it went on, all these conspiracy theories about what had happened to me. Had I consumed too much lead and stuff like that? some people, you know, had on some other YouTube videos that I saw were linked to stuff I'd done, were talking about going through some of my blog posts, trying to find out what my fate had been. And I simply had other things to do. And lockdown had been very difficult. And, you know, life had taken me in a different place. And it wasn't something that I had time or inclination to do. But I knew I need to make sure everybody knows that I'm not dead. So I came back, was it 2024? Was it just after Christmas? I think I'd seen this, 2024. So I decided to come back. I need to do a I'm not dead post. So I wrote The Road to Warhammer and Beyond, the first blog post that I'd done for God knows how long. And I just because I'd spent so much time thinking about what made my love of this sort of fantasy stuff so enduring, it was very much 80s culture, wasn't it? And I talk about He-Man, which amusingly I've got my class into. I've got a year three class and I tell them about the 80s and I told them about He-Man and I showed them He-Man, you know, during a wet play. Let's have a look at He-Man. And modern children, they could not believe they could not believe He-Man. They couldn't believe it. The fact that you had, you know, kids' TV shows with fighting in, they couldn't believe it. I mean, I showed them that By the Power of Grayskull opener. They couldn't believe it. She-Ra, at Christmas, we had to watch the special. You know, this stuff still appeals to children now, you know. Robin of Sherwood was something else that I remember watching. That music, wasn't it? And you can actually, I now realise, as an adult, how much of Robin of Sherwood is in the 80s Wood Elves. You can see Jez Goodwin has put a lot of things to that in it. Obviously, the Dungeons & Dragons TV cartoon. Venger is a bloodthirster, isn't he, really? If the wings are the same, he's a bloodthirster. And I started to realise, you know, you can see where they were taking their ideas from. They were just taking their ideas from here, there and everywhere. Krull was another one, Labyrinth, Neverending Story, Willow. Yeah, Thundercats. I mean, this stuff's fantastic, isn't it? I mean, my partner's son loved the A-Team. We showed him the A-Team a couple of months ago. He just fell in love with the A-Team. Mr. T absolutely loves Mr. T. He had to get an A-Team van. How many six-year-olds wanted an A-Team van from Father Christmas? He did. He got two of them. Favourite toy ever. You know, and to hear him push it around, you know, and say, "Shut it, you fool," you know, that sort of stuff. Okay, you love Mr. T, don't you? I say, "You want to be Mr. T?" "No, I want to be the one with white hair." I said, "Who?" He means Hannibal Smith. He wants to be him because he's in charge, but he likes Mr. T more. And then other things that got us interested, like Barbarian, the game on the Commodore 64, the Ultima games, you know, all this stuff, it's all linked, isn't it? And I realized a lot of the stuff I've been doing over the last 5-6 years, like playing The Witcher, Baldur's Gate and stuff like that, really, I'm playing this stuff because I liked all that Games Workshop stuff. So, yeah, I wrote a blog post just to see what would happen. Would anybody notice? You know, the other thing that amused me that I'd seen that people were saying on YouTube was the amount of spam. Oh my God, the spam of Realm of Chaos 80s. Yeah, there were tens of thousands of people, witch doctors, trying to sell people penis enlargements, you know, all this kind of stuff. I thought when I went back, there's no way I'm going to delete any of that. And also, the blog's so old, there's posts on there where the links are broken. And I just thought, I'm not going to go back and do some work to, you know, preserve stuff that's in the past. What's the point? I might as well do new stuff and see where that goes. In sort of my very limited way. So I wrote this post and I think I put it on Facebook as well. And it just went massive. I think I had like 40, 50 people contact me relatively quickly. People who I didn't even know would contact me and go, "Oh my God, I can't believe you're back. Can you do this? Can you do that?" And that obviously really spurred me on. I thought, yeah, I'm going to get blogging again and try and learn to paint again and try and do all this stuff again after so long. But of course, I had absolutely nothing. But one thing I'd always be incredibly grateful for is the community came to my rescue, and I just received, you know, package after package. I mean, the ladies at work just couldn't fathom what was going on. That, you know, every week or so I'd get huge boxes. A guy called Ian sent me loads of paints, so I actually had paints to work with, you know. So many people contacted me and said, "I've got old models that you can have." Everyone's got embarrassingly massive lead piles, haven't they? So through the post, I've just got endless piles of people's knickknacks that to them were like worthless bits and bobs, but to me were actually something I could use. And I was lucky enough when I bought this house, run down that it was, is it had a old carpentry workshop out the back, which I've sort of started to turn into my sort of hobby space. And, you know, I always loved the skeleton horde. So I thought, surely it's possible to get a few skeleton horde figures together. So I managed to get those. And then some generous benefactor just sent me an entire skeleton army set, all broken, of course, which I've been slowly restoring. And actually restoring things is something that I quite enjoy now. So I've recently was at a hobby place near where I live, and there's a guy in there, and he's got boxes and boxes and boxes of plastic toot, as I call it, either plastic models. But hidden amongst it, there are little treasures, and I managed to find in one of these stores, I think it's one of the demons, a lead thing. He had a little bit of lead rot on it. I got it downstairs. I said, "How much is this, mate?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm going to chuck that." He says, I'll have it. I think I gave him £1 for it with some plastic. He also had some old plastic Britain's trees. You know, those old Britain's trees that were found. He had some of them as well that he was just going to lob out. "I only do the plastic, mate." I mean, he didn't know what he had on his hands, didn't he, really? So I've rescued that to fix up. Yeah, I've got all kinds of bits and bobs. But the trouble with me is I can't focus on any one thing. I get distracted so easily. So I end up painting a million and one things and never finish them. So yeah, I really do need to get back on with that skeleton hoard, because at least I have a bit of something, don't I? But I've been able to slowly get back a lot of my magazine and book collection from various places. And quite pleasingly, I was able to find all the white boxes of stuff that I got from the foundry a fair few months ago. I found in a box of my old stuff that got dropped off by. And I found a lot of that stuff in it. So slowly my collection's coming back, but it is very small compared to what it used to be like, an embarrassingly massive pile of lead that was never going to get painted. And actually, I would recommend that to anybody. Get rid of everything and start again. You'd be amazed how that focuses the mind and gets, I think you're weighed down. I think we're all like Smaug, really, aren't we? We're sitting on our massive pile of treasure that we're never going to be able to do anything with. And if a little hobbit comes and takes, you know, a rogue trader beaky with a melter, you'll notice it's gone. "Oh, you bring my melter figure back, you naughty person." But I'm not going to paint it. It's just going to sit there, isn't it? You know, so actually getting rid of everything, having a good clear out, starting again, is good for anybody. But of course, my old habits have crept in and I've started to just start 101 things and not finish anything. But when I got that case of stuff from that 2000 period recently, I've spent the little time I've had repairing a lot of that. I've only got the really broken stuff left to do now. But it was quite nice to go through that era. And that's why I spoke about it actually earlier on, because I'm lucky enough to have some bits and pieces from that time. And yeah, it's not as great as the 80s stuff, but it was still a really good point for the company, and it was a very creative time, and some of the models and even the plastic kits look good.
Well, it's great to have you back and great to see the site active again. And yeah, it's my favorite site on the internet.
So a lot of people say that. I never really worked out why. Loads of me, there was a funny story. I was walking around in an Essex town with my new partner a few years ago, and we were walking, doing some shopping, and we hadn't known each other long. And coming down the street was a fellow enthusiast. I recognized him straight away. There was something about the way he walked. You just knew he loved 80s lead. I just knew. And as he got closer to me, his leather jacket, you know, swung open, and there it was. He had an Old Hammer t-shirt on. And I remember stopping him and saying, "Oh, you like Old Hammer, do you? You like that stuff?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, I love all that 80s stuff." I used to go, "Yeah, I used to collect a lot of that stuff and had it myself." Like, oh yeah, did you, mate? Yeah, I used to put it on online. "Oh, yeah, what was your name?" And I said, "Oh, it was Orlig." And the guy just stopped and went, "What, who did Realm of Chaos 80s? I said, "Yeah." "Oh, I love that blog, man. I love that blog. Why don't you?" And I didn't really take it seriously, but I never worked out quite what the appeal was. No one could ever tell me, what was it? I mean, what was, if I could bottle it, maybe I could sell it. What was it that made people so, you know, enthusiastic of one bloke rambling on about old miniatures? I'm interviewing you now.
Yeah, no, it's just the whole package. It's the photos, it's the anecdotes, it's the fact that it's a blog as well. Like, you've talked about that there, you know, the role of the blog. It's such a far cry from what a lot of people do on the internet now. It's the doom scroll and the YouTube videos with the big clickbaity thumbnails. Now it's just so far removed from that. It's a calm,
I know what
relaxed
you mean.
Approach.
Yeah, I have a system. If a YouTuber has headphones on and a microphone is visible. Never go near them. Why do you need headphones and a microphone in shot? I mean, TV shows have spent years avoiding that. Why does this somehow make you knowledgeable about your subject? You've got to have a microphone there and some headphones. And now I'm going to shout at you a lot in my video about Warhammer 3rd edition. Guess what, guys? You had no rules in those days. Whoa, isn't that crazy? It's not my kind of thing. Well, thank you for telling me that. At least I know that. Just keep on rambling, then, is the lesson. Keep on rambling. I mean, someone said to me recently when we were talking about Wayne the Duke, about the photos, because it was interesting that you mentioned the photos. And it actually goes back to the first thing that got me into blogging with Fansense when he did that Orcs Drift stuff. And I know exactly what you mean. And some other guy had said this to me recently in one of the comments. It's the gribbly look of the photos, the 80s photos, that give a lot of this stuff its edge, if you know what I mean. And I think this guy was totally right. Those gribbly photos, the lighting's not great, is it? The quality's not great because they're using 1980s technology. The lighting's bad because it was probably lit by a cigarette dangling out of someone's lips, wasn't it? But it kind of captures that make it up as you go along feel. And actually, I've been playing around with some modern filters. And yeah, it's something I'm quite keen to do in the future, see if you can get that kind of gribbly look. Because I've got a workshop and I've been using the two lamps, because I was lucky enough, wasn't I, to interview Phil Lewis, who was the lensman, wasn't he, at Games Workshop back then. I interviewed him years ago about how he actually took these pictures. Because, of course, we're lazy, aren't we? We have digital cameras now. Don't like the picture? I'll delete it and I'll take it again. Back then, they had to do it with real film. And I imagine that Games Workshop would have had this elaborate photographic setup. It wasn't. It was a bit of paper, two lights and a camera on a tripod. And they didn't know, did they, if the photo would come out until they developed it. So you really have to admire those people who took some really great photos that we still love now with the most basic equipment. But they loved it, didn't they? These guys loved what they were doing, and it shows in the end result, which is something I don't think we have so much in Games Workshop and computer games and corporate things anymore, because these people are there to pay a mortgage, aren't they? It's a job now. You know, I'm coming along to develop my AAA game. I'm coming along to develop 12th edition Warhammer, or whatever I'm going to call it now. But I'm doing it because it's my job and I've got a mortgage to pay. I'm not doing it because I love it. I think I love it, but I'm not sure that they love it in the same way as those people who are totally immersed in something that is individual to you. You know what I mean? Because I met people, one of the things that got me into Old Hammer is they would say things like, you painted your Space Marines wrong. I remember being told this, you know, you've painted that color scheme. And they'd get these codex books out and they'd go, no, look, that needs to be red around that shield. And that people, they took this so seriously. There was no storytelling or adventure or fun behind it. It all seemed to be about proving the opposing player to be wrong, either in their understanding of the fluff or their understanding of the rules. And it didn't seem to be a joyous spectacle anymore. And that was one of the things that I loved about certainly my involvement with Old Hammer up to this day, was that people just loved what they were doing. And I'm sure in any hobby, you know, you'd find people like that. So if you're surrounded by the negative types, go out and find the more positive types. I'm sure they're there. But beware, you will meet some really crazy characters. Yes, that's kind of a plus if you meet interesting people.
Massive thanks to Orlig for spending some time with us and sharing so many incredible stories. We did only just scratch the surface as well, so I'm talking to him about arranging a part two in the very near future, so keep an eye and an ear open for that. I will, of course, put a link to the Realm of Chaos 80s blog in the show notes, and I'll just give a quick shout out as well to the Minigamer newsletter that comes out every Tuesday, and you could sign up for free by going to bedroombattlefields.com/email. That's bedroombattlefields.com/email. Alright, that is it for this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Thanks as always for listening, and we'll chat again on the next one.